Well, good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. If you listened to Amy Goodman yesterday, you would have learned or remembered that this week is the 50th anniversary of the beginning of the massive air campaign against Laos by the United States, which lasted from 1964 to 1972. It seems to have been the most extensive bombing campaign of the 20th century. And like the parallel U.S. bombing of neighboring Vietnam those very same years, both North and South, exceeded the use of bombs during World War II. In Laos alone, the number of bombs dropped on that tiny country was about one bomb every 8 minutes for 8 years. And of course, there's never been a tally, at least as far as we know, as to how many were killed or injured during those 8 years. And it is 100 years since the war to end all wars began, 50 years prior to that bombing campaign and our involvement in that war, the Vietnam War. And that's the subject of this program. And it's something I wrote, so I should probably give you the disclaimer that this is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only, in all of the cosmos and multiple and parallel universes. I call it the war to end all wars, and I start with a quote from Leon Trotsky. History had already poised this gigantic soldier's boot on the anteap. And from Winston Churchill. And a knell rang in the ears of the victors, even in the hour of their triumph. It might be said that the 20th century commenced 100 years ago, this coming Saturday, June 28, 1914. That was the day the heir to the Austro-Hungarian Empire was assassinated, as was his wife, in Sarajevo, in Serbia. This precipitated the first stage of World War I. Nearly 2 months of a confused and altogether conflicting flurry of political and diplomatic disputes between the envoys of European kings, kaisers, czars, and emperors enmeshed in a quagmire of provocative treaties and alliances, as well as rival imperial ambitions and anxieties. Then in early August, the Soldiers' War began, when no one seemed able or willing to compromise to prevent war. And Germany's armies swept through Belgium to attack its ancient enemy, France. By the time World War I ended 96 years ago on November 11, 1918, the empires and societies of pre-war Europe had disappeared or were disrupted beyond recognition. The most concentratedly horrendous war in history lasted 4 years, 3 months, and 1 week, or 1,563 days. More than 10 million were counted dead, the majority of them soldiers. The death rate of British, French, and German soldiers exceeded that of World War II. 20 million more were wounded. And approximately 10% of casualties were civilians in World War I, compared to 90% in wars at the end of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st. And you might as well throw Laos and Vietnam into that also. The war cost more than $300 billion and destroyed empires and this is a quote, dethroned dynasties. The Hohenzollern in Germany, Habsburg, Austro-Hungarian, Romanov in Russia, the 7th-century-old Turkish Ottoman Empire, which at its height covered much of Eastern Europe, Palestine, Egypt, and North Africa. New regimes were started at the war's final hours in Vienna, Warsaw, Budapest, Prague, and Dublin. Revolutionaries roared through Berlin and St. Petersburg. The next war, a generation later, would decimate many more times civilians than combatants as a result of technological improvements in artillery, long-range bombing, and the development of nuclear power. World War I was a short-range war. Artillery, bombs, poison gas, flamethrowers, and machine guns were primarily aimed at soldiers, the poor unknowns whose deaths prematurely exhausted the vitality of an entire generation. The killing stopped an hour before noon on November 11, 1918, after four terrible years of unimaginable bloodshed that nearly destroyed European civilization. Much of Europe was in ruins, its economies devastated. Millions were dead and millions more were displaced, homeless, hungry, hopeless. No other war was as atrocious to its soldiers except the American Civil War, half a century earlier. In each, the infantry were charged en masse into sure death, and the battlefields of both wars were littered with the corpses of thousands. Rapid advances in weaponry were not matched in either war by changes in tactics. Civil War leaders charged their troops into mass formations of riflemen and artillery. World War I generals sent their soldiers against barbed wire and machine guns. The paralyzing trench warfare of the later war was a desperate innovation of the former. World War II, with the exception of a few major sieges, such as at Stalingrad, was a war of mobility. Perhaps the most significant event of World War I was the birth of the Soviet communist state in Russia, which was a revolt against the war itself. A liberal element of upper bourgeoisie attempted to curtail hardcore revolution by usurping the Tsar in the spring of 1917. The attempt failed when the Bolsheviks seized power in the October Revolution, which actually took place in November. Russia adhered to an earlier calendar at the time. Germany had cut a deal with Bolshevik leader Lenin for a truce, and the initial effect was to free German divisions from the Russian front to meet the new threat of an armed America entering the war on the side of England and France, co-belligerents to German ambitions of European supremacy, or, as history names them, the Allies. Soviet Russia and Nazi Germany were the central antagonists of World War II. The Great Patriotic War, as the Russians called their incredible struggle against the Nazis, was the peak of the communist revolution, though the Soviets inherited an empire as spoils of the war and waged a Cold War against Western Europe, the United States, and their spheres of influence for nearly half a century. The war against Germany fatally weakened the infrastructure of the United Socialist Soviet Republic, even as it expanded like a giant red star into an empire that spread across most of Eastern Europe. In particular, its bloated military, combined with increasing internal corruption and social paralysis, were as fatal as syphilis, ignored for decades until insanity and death. World War II was a direct consequence of its predecessor, a second act determining the hegemony of Europe. The peace conference at Versailles at the end of World War I disintegrated into vengeance against Germany. Indemnities were so prohibitive that a weak democracy was stillborn and ultimately collapsed in Berlin, replaced by the century's worst citizen, Hitler, and his National Socialist Party. Germany rearmed in disregard of Versailles and launched the second major war of the 20th century in September 1939 by attacking Poland. At first, the Nazis neutralized Russian reaction by signing a treaty with Stalin, who might contend as the century's second-worst citizen. He was an even greater murderer than Hitler. The Soviets used their brief pact with Germany to attack Finland and annex the Baltic states of Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, which only regained independence with the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. But Hitler's great plan was to annihilate the Slavic people who occupied the great fertile plains of Russia and recolonize with Germans. After blitzkrieging Western Europe with the exception of Britain, neutral Switzerland, and Sweden, also fascist Spain, more than a million Nazi troops, aided by Italians, vengeful Finns, and Spanish volunteers, and that's in quotes, attacked Russia in the summer of 1941, 6 months before Japan brought the United States into the war with a surprise attack upon Pearl Harbor. Germany made its two most fatal errors that year. First, with this invasion of Russia. Second, its declaration of war upon the USA a few days after the Japanese air assault on Hawaii. Two nuclear bombs ended World War II, which might have put an end to war for good. Instead, a nuclear arms race between two conflicting and aggressive ideologies, the United States and the Soviet Union, allies and victors in the war against Nazism, divided the world. The two world wars left Europe in ruins. European hegemony passed to the rival superpowers. The result was a balance of terror, defended by arguments that only nuclear parity could prevent a third world war. The U.S. and the USSR spent hundreds of billions of dollars developing their nuclear arsenals, each government posing the threat of the other to continually escalate the race. Each claimed to be defending itself against the world-dominating ambitions of the other and the contradictory idea of preventive war. Starting a war to prevent a war was a common rationale for threatening world obliteration. The two superpowers derived their power from increasing their arsenals and making treaties that allowed for more and deadlier weapons. At the same time, the U.S. and the USSR were racing through generations of nuclear weapons. Both built up their conventional forces and exported weapons and troops to small wars that erupted all over the globe. Each war was a threat of nuclear confrontation, yet simultaneously these wars skirted oblivion by acting as pressure releases against the big blow. A ritualized response was soon evident. Whenever a war of national liberation erupted, usually indigenous rebels breaking away from Western colonialism in Asia and Africa, or from strong-armed dictators in Latin America, the U.S. attempted to counter the revolts with force, covert activities that included murder and assassination, and money, pursuing a rim policy of containment against communism that often benefited the Soviet Union, which generally supported the rebels at the same time it communized them. Whenever a communist bloc nation threatened to break away, as with Hungary and Czechoslovakia, Moscow brutally suppressed the revolt, except in Afghanistan, which was its Vietnam. I. F. Stone wrote of these brushfire wars. It was not what the war would do to the peasant on both sides, his wife and children, his cow or goat and his hopes, which stirred concern, but what it might do to the balance of power. And that was I. F. Stone. Wars have been smaller since the two world wars, but no less vicious or horror-filled for the combatants and civilians increasingly swept up in the maelstrom. The Iran-Iraq War killed 1 million combatants, the costliest post-World War II conflict. As in World War I, mass attacks were made against machine guns and artillery. Even after the end of the Cold War, each conflict that rages in the post-communist era is conducted in the shadow of nuclear holocaust, India and Pakistan, for example. The U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan in revenge against 9/11 at the beginning of this century, so-called wars against terrorism that are in reality more about replacing the balances of power in the Mideast and in particular control of oil supplies, have altered the nuclear equilibrium of terror, succeeded by a possibly more dangerous imbalance by an upsurge of nuclear ambitious nations. And though the original nuclear superpowers have played a charade of defanging their arsenals, proliferation of bootleg nuclear weapons and technology, as well as biological warfare agents, has been worldwide since the collapse of communist Russia. War has affected civilization tremendously, but its effect upon those who suffered firsthand is given little consideration. Wars determine the reaction and consequent effect upon a society, and recovery is often a long, slow process. Those with personal involvement in a war are not accorded the same respect for their own process of recovery. Their personal horrors and nightmares of war are dealt with impatiently and with scorn at possible psychological or physical disabilities, though collectively these sorts of disruptions and discontinuities are accepted as part of the historic process. The short, grim life of soldiers was never more apparent than during the stalemate of trench warfare in Western Europe. World War I artillery and airplanes were not as able to kill at long range as they later were. Soldiers were the main targets. The shells and bombs that fell upon them like rain for 4 years made mockeries of courage, fear, and sacrifice. Whom the shells or bombs missed, the machine guns harvested. A French soldier who fought at Verdun wrote, "We all had on us the stench of dead bodies. The bread we ate, the stagnant water we drank, everything we touched had a rotten smell, owing to the fact that the earth around us was literally stuffed with corpses." Arthur Graham wrote in a poem, "And everywhere the dead, only the dead were always present, present as a vile, sickly smell of rottenness, infecting earth and air." The Great War, the war to end all wars, consumed a generation of European men and hundreds of thousands of colonial troops from Africa and Asia, plus thousands more from Australia, New Zealand, and North America. It was a soldiers' war, perhaps the last, in which soldiers were the primary casualties. Siegfried Sassoon, one of a handful to emerge as major poets from World War I, wrote, "Soldiers are citizens of death's gray land, drawing no dividend from time's tomorrows." Sassoon's friend, Wolfert Owen, considered the war's best poet, was killed just before it ended. "Who are these purgatorial shadows?" he wrote of badly wounded soldiers, "bearing teeth that leer like skulls, teeth wicked, stroke on stroke of pain. But what slow panic gouged these chasms round their fretted sockets, and from their hair and through their hands, palms, misery swelters. Surely we have perished, sleeping and walk in hell. But who these hellish?" "With them in hell," Owen wrote in another poem, "the sorrowful dark of hell, whose world is but the trembling of a flare, and heaven but as the highway for a shell." John Ellis wrote in "Eye Deep in Hell, Trench Warfare in World War I," that the Western Front should be remembered as an unparalleled nightmare of filth, decay, noise, blood, and death, in which men fought for reasons they hardly understood, for a future they almost ceased to believe in, and which offered nothing when it came. The soldiers of World War I, Philip Gibbs said, lived in a world of ours as though they belonged to another race of men inhabiting another planet. After four grotesque years, an armistice ended World War I. The guns were silent at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, 1918. Armistice is defined as a temporary truce, but to the 28th American president, Thomas Woodrow Wilson, the armistice 96 years ago was to be an end to war forever. He had campaigned for a second term on a promise to stay out of the European war. But in 1917, he ordered American soldiers into the carnage, primarily in retaliation to Germany's declaration of unrestricted submarine warfare on the oceans. Wilson was obsessed with his responsibility for having sent his countrymen to war. He had 14 points he wished adopted as part of the Versailles Peace Treaty the following year, 1919. He emphasized the duties of a strong nation, and that year, as it was later in 1945, the U.S. was the most powerful in the world. He used the new status of the U.S. to push his ideas for world peace and a League of Nations at Versailles. Humanity, however, responds quicker to hatred and opportunity than to peace for its own sake, and never are these traits more well represented than through its humble servants arguing over the spoils of a defeated nation. Civilizations have profited immensely from wars, and warfare has progressed civilization's expanse and technologies. Yet war has also turned out the lights of civilization. Humanity has been set back centuries by its predilection for war, long periods of decline and retrogression, generations denied opportunities of learning and rebuilding. Wilson's intent was to end these interminable cycles of darkness. He failed, at Versailles and at home. His high moral tone was no more palatable to the primarily Republican Senate, particularly his arch foe, Henry Cabot Lodge, than it was to Francis Clemenceau and the feasting Allies. Wilson died a few years later, miserably aware his hopes for a League of Nations had failed and that wars were erupting all over the planet. Armistice Day was a symbol of peace for several years. Each Armistice Day, a full minute of silence was observed at the 11th hour in memory of the fallen. By the time German armies broke out of their reservation in 1939, millions who had hopes for peace at the end of the Great War were dead from newer wars, political violence, executions, pogroms. Perhaps as many as 60 million died in the 1939-1945 war. Armistice Day lost its poignancy in the ashes of World War II, and before they cooled, the West and East were divided by an iron curtain, as Winston Churchill eloquently described a bicameral post-war world of conflicting empires. A Cold War almost immediately replaced the Hot War. Armistice Day in the United States was changed to honor the services of veterans to the state, instead of recalling war's costs. All who survived World War I are finally dead, joining at last their comrades who died in the trenches and on the wire. In the USA, they follow the old soldiers of the Spanish-American War and the last veteran of the Civil War, a Confederate soldier who died in 1959. The World War II generation, so young in the countless replays of 1940s war movies, is aged and rapidly dying away now. Soon Vietnam War veterans will be the elder war generation, following the exit of those who fought in Korea. Erich Maria Remarque, author of All Quiet on the Western Front, wrote in his second book, The Road Back, a question by the father of a returning German soldier after the 1918 armistice. Now tell us about your experiences. Experiences? I repeat and think to myself. I haven't experienced anything. It was just war all the time. How should a man have experiences there? Remarque wrote in his earlier book, perhaps the best ever written about war, All Quiet on the Western Front, I am young. I am 20 years old, yet I know nothing of life but despair, death, fear, and fatuous superficiality cast over an abyss of sorrow. I see how peoples are set against one another, and in silence, unknowingly, foolishly, obediently, innocently, slay one another. I see that the keenest brains of the world invent weapons and words to make it all yet more refined and enduring. And all men of my age, here and over there, throughout the whole world, see these things. All my generation is experiencing these things with me. What would our fathers do if we suddenly stood up and came before them and preferred our account? What do they expect of us if a time ever comes when the war is over? Through the years, our business has been killing. It was our first calling in life. Our knowledge of life is limited to death. What will happen afterwards? And what shall come out of us? And that was Remarque, All Quiet on the Western Front. Ezra Pound wrote an epitaph for the soldiers of World War I in refute of misty-eyed sentimentality, and that's a quote, that characterized popular commemoration, pardon me, of Armistice Day. Died some pro patria, non dulce, non et decor, walked I deep in hell, believing in old men's lies, then unbelieving, came home, home to a lie, home to many deceits, home to old lies and new infamy. And sort of an epilogue to what I just read. The state of Oregon, which mobilized the 1st National Guard unit from Portland to serve in World War I, the state sent two guard units to fight Pancho Villa in 1916, sent a total of 44,166 Oregonians to the war, 1,030 of whom were KIA and 1,100 WIA, wounded in action. And it should not be forgotten that twice as many people worldwide died in the influenza epidemic of 1918 to 1920. 3,675 died in Oregon, then were killed in World War I. And a bit of a personal postscript. My paternal grandfather and his brother Herb were in the U.S. Army in World War I. My grandfather was a machine gun company officer in France and was later sent to Archangel to quell Bolsheviks. He was a founding member of the American Legion. My uncle Herb was an enlisted army reporter with infantry and survived intense combat. Half a century later, I had the same type of job with the USMC in Vietnam, with infantry and also reconnaissance. My grandfather died on Pearl Harbor Day 1972 in his late 80s. He reigned as the family war veteran for 50 years. My father was rejected for World War II service because of his age, childhood tuberculosis, and his position in industrial medical supply, a company owned by my grandfather, which was considered crucial to the war effort. My return from Vietnam not only dispossessed my grandfather from his warrior's throne, my consequent opposition to the war and the U.S. military, culminating in my helping organize chapters of Vietnam Veterans Against the War, of which I was a charter member, like my grandfather was of the American Legion. This made us adversaries for the rest of his life. Uncle Herb, on the other hand, would have approved. He died in 1964, editor of a small newspaper in Florida, after years of robust migrant journalism. He was disappointed that I chose newspapering as a career. He wrote in his last letter to me that I should be a pamphleteer, which, as editor-publisher of the North Coast Times-Eagle for nearly 30 years, I suppose I achieved that conversion. To perhaps put World War I into a personal context, my year in Vietnam might have been equivalent to only one day on the Somme or at Verdun. And that's, again, The War to End All Wars, which I wrote. And I guess I will read something that I read at the, no, I won't. Running rapidly out of time, so I think I'll just hold that. It's a statement I made at the Planning Commission meeting last Tuesday, and to tell you the truth, I think it was received by planning commissioners and the developers who want to transgress on the waterfront as if I was from another planet. So I will save it for another time. There is another meeting on July 22nd for the Planning Commission, and of course the City Council will have the last say of what does happen. So stay tuned.